It's time now for World Watchers International with Mae Brussel, who for over 17 years has investigated and exposed political conspiracies worldwide. World Watchers International originates at KLRB, Carmel, California. Here's Mae.
Good evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. This is broadcast number 514, October the 11th, 1981. Before I get into the subject of Anwar Sadat and the murder this week, I want to mention the death of an author. Some of you may know of him, some of you have never heard of him. 84 years old, he wasn't assassinated. John L. Spivak. A friend gave me a copy of his book, Secret Armies, a few years ago. It was published in 1939, a very important book about Nazi infiltration throughout various countries in the world, in the United States, England, South America, and the activities of the Nazis spread around the world and the intent to keep the Nazi organization going for a long, long time. He passed away October the 5th. This was last Monday. As I say, 84 years old. He spent a great deal of his life exposing Nazis pre-war. This is before Germany invaded Poland. This book came out, the pre-war Nazis that were in America. He wrote about the Klan and corrupt institutions in the United States. He was described as the best reporter the United States ever had, and identical to George Seldes, who's written many fine books, who is still alive. His name is unknown to many researchers, and that's why I want to bring it up this evening and bring it up in the beginning before I rush through some of the other stories and get in a hurry later. He worked for the New York Sun. He was the New York Call representative in Berlin and Moscow. In early years when the Hitler army was just forming, when Nazism was just coming to full bloom in the 1920s, he went into investigative reporting. This is John L. Spivak. He covered coal strikes in West Virginia, the Sacco Vanzetti murder, the Ku Klux Klan in America. And in 1937, that was 2 years before the invasion of Poland, he called attention to Henry Ford's private secretary, William Cameron. He was the first person to say that he was the leader of the American Nazi movement in the United States. And of course, Henry Ford was instrumental in arming Adolf Hitler and the Nazis for World War II. He wrote about the German government in 1937. This was 2 years before this book, one book, Secret Armies, came out. The German government in those days spent $2.5 million, which was a lot, in 1937 for propaganda in the United States favoring Germany and the Nazi regime. Some of the books that he wrote, The Devil's Brigade, Georgia Nigger, America Faces the Barricades, that was in 1935 on the fall of capitalism. Europe Under the Terror, that was the exposure of atrocities of Adolf Hitler and Mussolini. Plotting America's Pogroms, Shrine of the Silver Dollar, A Pattern of American Fascism, and then an autobiography in 1967, A Man in His Times. With regard to what he was saying in 1939 in the book Secret Armies and his talk about fascism, and Henry Ford just relating it to one incident, the John Kennedy assassination, there was a Lawrence Orloff, a white Russian czarist, with George de Morenschild, a Nazi spy during World War II. The two men visited Marina Oswald when she came from the Soviet Union to the Fort Worth area before they had even moved up to Dallas. And Orloff was in contact with Henry Ford and the Ford Motor people up in Michigan in those days. That was in 1963. 1962, just prior to the murder of John Kennedy that took place a year later. And as soon as John Kennedy was murdered, the car that he was in was delivered directly. It was taken to Washington for a couple days and delivered directly to the Ford Motor Company. And they now have that car that John Kennedy was assassinated in. But I've linked through the years, and I won't go back and give the details now, the role of Nazi organizations and Nazi agents in the assassination of John Kennedy, and then that carries through to the Robert Kennedy assassination, Martin Luther King, and other murders in this country. But it was Spivak who wrote in 1939 that Henry Ford's private secretary was the leader of the American Nazi Party. And I wanted to mention that he passed away this week. And if you have a chance, get some of these books from used bookstores or libraries. I only have actually one book of his, Secret Armies, and I haven't been able to obtain the others, but I certainly want to try to do that. Last week on KLRB, on this program, I gave some important dates to remember of American history and German history to go back to, because these dates would influence the news as it would break in our headlines for the years to come. I mentioned Hitler in 1943 going underground and deciding to set up the Fourth Reich, the meetings of Himmler and the Gestapo in 1943 to set up a web, a spider web of Nazis throughout the entire world for the World War III that would follow. And in 1944, the meeting of the industrialists to take the capital, the money out of Germany through companies such as IG Farben and invest it around the world. Another date in 1944 of the intent to do kidnappings, political assassinations, and terrorism to achieve their goals in the future. Now, why did I give those dates to you? I gave them because of the events that you are going to see fall and just gush out in the years to come, ever since Ronald Reagan became the President of the United States, have to do with those early days that were set, and that Reagan is the front for those long-laid plans that are now working very nicely, and that is why we're seeing so many coups and changes of governments or attempted murders or murders ever since Ronald Reagan was elected and took his oath of office. The murders will keep rolling along because this secret team has achieved what they want in the personage of that Hollywood actor who is the front man for that group. And I was on the air last Sunday night on this station, and Monday I did a guest spot on another local station that I go once a month or so, K-Ocean, to talk about the update of the news for the month and described the possibility of future murders and assassinations and mentioned both Gaddafi and Sadat. And, of course, the next morning, Sadat was dead. I wanted to add some more dates to your list. Those of you who get these tapes and have the printed sheets, and those of you who listen, can listen carefully, because the murder of Anwar Sadat just didn't happen in a vacuum. It just didn't take place that four crazy fanatics decided to shoot him at that moment in time. All of these murders have a repetition, a pattern, and the same background. And if I go over them with you, you can see the similarities through the years. But the groundwork for them, setting the stage for what is to follow, took place way back in those early years, just as World War II was declining. Another date to put on your list of importance was September 1st, 1944, when the German military went on the radio in Brussels, on the Nazi radio, and said, one of the top officials said, one day we shall come back. Until then, a bientôt, we will return. They said that at the end of World War I, that they would be back by 1939. February 26, 1945, and keep in mind, Roosevelt died in April of 1945, and the peace treaty wasn't signed till late April 1945, but February, 2 months before the war was over, the Soviet Union had documents in their possession that there were plans to convert the Nazi Party into an underground group for the Third World War. This was in the possession of the Soviet Union, and they still have those documents. And in November 1943, that was just a few months after the decision to go underground, the French resistance had a publication that was available in Algiers, a text saying that the conquest for the world will require numerous stages, and those people responsible for controlling France when Hitler had the control of France, a General Otto von Stulpnagel, would be in charge of the various stages for the conquest of the world. Now, this conquest has been planned going back from the time of the Versailles Treaty until World War II was over, which they didn't accept, the Nazis didn't accept as a defeat, but just a stalling place to get ready for World War III. So when you read about laser beams and weapons and neutron bombs and atomic bombs and missiles and AWACS, this is the plot that was hatched that far ago, and In many, many books, I have literally hundreds of books of dates that carry you from that stage right up to the present day. In the book, The Plot Against the Peace, A Warning to the Nation, this was in 1945, similar to John Spivak's book in 1939, warning the United States in 1945 how the Germans planned to come back, how they would use terrorism, sabotage, they also wrote a book called Sabotage, Political Assassination, to achieve what they wanted. And the methods of going about this process of gaining World War III, the Fourth Reich, are listed, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And they were very repetitious in the way they did things, and the rules were always the same, but they've been very successful in achieving their goals. Now, an important part of this book, this Plot Against the Peace, tells about the repetition and the success of the German general staff, and they define German general staff as not only the military leaders, but the economic leaders, the political leaders, and so forth. They used a plan that worked, and it worked once, it worked twice, and then now they're doing a third time. And the reason I bring it up tonight is the assassination plots, and I've drawn conspiracy chains and assassination chains, are all the same. They have a formula nobody has called a halt to. It's worked all of these years from 1919 to 1981. Why would they change? The people don't have their smarts yet and haven't been able or cared enough to confront the powers that be to break the chain. Now, this one book mentions the German general staff. This is The Plot Against the Peace. It said, they're not very imaginative. Once they conceive a plan, it follows it step by step, again and again and again. And no matter what happens, they're like burglars who continually leave their signatures behind them at the scene of the robbery. The German general staff conducts its conspiracy today, that was in 1945, precisely as it did 30 years ago in 1919. And on February 26, 1945, they left documents, as I say, pointing one down the numbers of how they would go about their Fourth Reich, how they would be able to have World War III. And they are systematic, and you can apply the same principles of the assassinations, which I studied at length for 8 years, the John Kennedy assassination. Then you take the Martin Luther King or the Robert Kennedy or John Lennon's murder or the assassination attempt on the Pope or Ronald Reagan. Whether the person's killed or whether they survive, the method, the modus operandi is the same. Whether they try to kill George Wallace and he survives, he is still neutralized to the sense of being silenced, and they have a method of controlling the people whether or not they die. So that studying the death of Anwar Sadat is not much different than studying the other deaths, except that some of the names change and some don't, and the circumstances web together with the past murders in a way that is understandable. As more of these events take place, I think they become more understandable, where they were completely misunderstood by Americans in 1963 when John Kennedy was assassinated. I had no teacher and no guide, and no person, member of the family or friend, to lead me or tell me where to go to look for the assassins. I had to do it myself, and now I'm lucky enough to be able to pass it on to you to study it and share this information with you. Now, with regard to the murder of Anwar Sadat, I've broken it down, as I usually do, into various subjects that I find necessary to discuss. And I'll briefly just list them off to you because I can't possibly discuss them in 1 hour or even in the remaining 45 minutes, but I will go into them next week and the week after, because whenever there is a major catastrophe, such as the death of John Paisley or the installation of the Polish Pope or the murder of Nelson Rockefeller, I usually set 3 hours, 1 hour each week, as the groundwork. And then as we update these events, you can put it into the original framework later. I'm going to talk in some this evening and later in the future on the cost of security for Anwar Sadat, the Sadat Mubarak feud that was going on since January, where Sadat was to replace him. The CIA and our federal governments and the Reagan staff knew 3 weeks before the killing that it was being planned. The CIA knew 24 hours before the killing that it was going to be planned. The lack of Egyptian security, which was equated as being worse than zero. The attack on the news cameras that were photographing it. The guns were turned on them instead of the people who were throwing the grenades. The chronology of events, because the chronology is always important in these stories, and I'll get into that tonight. An update of our coups since Reagan was in office in January 1981. The sale of Santa Fe International, a very important story, the largest builder for the Egyptian government, who it went to this week, in case you don't know, and some surprises on that. Hagen Reagan and the reaction to Sadat up to this date. George Bush and his warnings of retaliations to countries. The similarities, some of them, between Sadat's murder and other important murders of heads of states, particularly King Faisal and the Henry Kissinger visit in 1975. The independent organizations that take credit for the murder, reducing it to no large plot, a handful of renegades. The U.S. funds in the Middle East, in Lebanon, Libya, and the countries where we say the violence is coming from. The importance of the expulsion of Russian journalists in Egypt in September, just 3 weeks ago. The historical importance of this shooting to the United States at this time, and that is a subject I want to go into with you at not great length, but just to summarize it. An interesting statement by Claiborne Pell, a congressman, on NBC the morning Sadat was shot. How many assassins? That always is questionable. Who is Mubarak? What does he do? What does he think? What is his background? The vice president that became the president of Egypt. The economy of Egypt at the present time and the problems that Anwar Sadat faced at home. The U.S. escalation of troops into the Middle East, which Haig is grabbing as his opportunity. And that goes into the category of motives for shooting Anwar Sadat, is that we'll have a full-scale application of troops and weapons and bombs right in Egypt, and we'll have our men right there assuring us of all of these war toys to make ready for turning the Middle East into a bloodbath like we did in Vietnam. I wrote in 1974 in one of my first published articles that when they were coming out of Vietnam, they would go directly to the Middle East to get ready for World War III over there. The same team, the same names. And then, of course, we'll go into the media control of the killing of Sadat, which was absolutely amazing, both in America, the United States, and in Egypt. And then the U.S. delegation, I call them the snakes. That is Gerald Ford, Richard Nixon, Jimmy Carter, and Haig. And I compare them to four of the most treacherous types of reptiles and their journey over there for the funeral. The funeral control, deciding where he was buried, who should be there, and so forth. Sadat's relationship to King Farouk and Great Britain, how he helped chase them out of Egypt. Why Sadat died alone, a lonely man. Then I will later, maybe next week, go into the CIA plans to kill Nasser when Sadat became president, documented by David Marks and Victor Marchetti in The Cult of Intelligence and Myle Copeland's book on the CIA. First, they get Farouk out. The CIA trains and works with Nasser and gets Farouk out, and the CIA takes over Egypt. And then we plan to kill Nasser, and we get in Sadat, and then Sadat is killed, and Mubarak is put in by our CIA. And then, of course, the effect of this particular Middle Eastern problem on certain countries, Israel, Great Britain, Libya, and Iran and the Soviet Union. Those are the only five countries that I think it directly affects to be very important, the murder of Sadat. And then the witnesses that are killed always in these stories so that the truth can't really be told as it should, and the discrepancies in the reports from the first. And then the blame, Pete McCloskey has a story today, the Jews are responsible for Sadat's death, and Randolph Hearst has to go into the terror network. Those the two ways that Adolf Hitler spread his propaganda with millions of dollars as early as 1932-35 in this country, and the Nazi Fourth Reich continues it today through these mouthpieces. You see, either the terrorists or the Jews. It's the same old script. It'll never end, and it was in the newspapers today. If it isn't the Terror Network, which is the newest craze because of the book by that name that came out this year to be synchronized with these operations of our CIA, if it isn't the terrorists, it has to be the Jews. And, of course, that's what you read in the paper and underneath the lines, and even people, as I say, like Pete McCloskey. Well, going down the line now, for as much as we can do, this week the cost of taking care of Sadat. Many of you might have seen the articles, but I just have to say it for laughs or sadness. $20 million of your tax dollars, maybe school lunch for some children, or I don't know what, abortions for the poor, or the raped, or whatever. Wherever you want to spend it, we've spent $20 million to keep Sadat safe. We spent $20 million to get Farouk out and England out of Egypt. We spent another $20 million to kill Nasser. Then we spent $20 million to keep Sadat alive, and it'll cost $20 million to keep Mubarak alive. That's about $20, $40, $60, $80 million. Changing heads of states in Egypt, the United States has gained very little for it except selling a lot of hardware for a handful of corporations that keep taking in their money. This goes back to the Nixon administration on up to the president, $20 million. And when they want him gone, he's gone. And it's a terrible waste of money. The CIA wants more secrecy these days. They want a larger budget of $22 billion. They're total idiots. And the one thing that we don't have that Germany had, and they can't direct us like they direct themselves, is self-discipline and their smarts. I don't think they ever wasted $20 million as easily as we did. But part of the plot to bring America down on its knees, maybe, and I believe it was, to encourage us to get into these various conflicts, such as South Korea, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Iran, Southeast Asia, all over the world, Egypt, into these various countries, is to bring us to the point of bankruptcy, spend our money wherever we can, and cause a rampant inflation with high interest rates, destabilize the United States, treat it as a conquered country, and we fell for all of that bait. And one of our expenses was the security of the head of Egypt, and when the CIA wants him out, he's out. Security doesn't mean a thing. Now, as far as the Sadat Mubarak feud, because there have been a lot of stories that a runaway renegade group were behind this assassination. The Israeli intelligence, which is very good, in fact, it's damn good, if you'll pardon me saying that, but it is, knew for a long time there was a struggle between these two men. It was described in the Los Angeles Examiner today, October the 11th, 1981. I was down in L.A. for the week and picked this up at the airport yesterday. A bitter struggle between these two men going back to January. That there was an illusion by the media that Hosni Mubarak was 100% loyal to Sadat, that he was a stereotype, that he was a subservient yes man. But Israeli intelligence picked up as early as January, the same time Reagan was getting into office, that he was not Sadat or anywhere near him. He was a backup any more than Lyndon Johnson was LBJ, and he said he would go for the Great Society, which is been wiped out or negated for the most part. Mubarak was not 100% loyal. Sadat wanted to fire him. He hired a watchdog to keep a close eye on him. And this reminds me of when Ronald Reagan came to office. He took one of the California justices in this court in California, Clark, and made him one of the deputies under Haig. And I had some articles that Reagan trusted Clark as a long friend from California. He put him on the court, trust him, and he want him to be in the State Department watching Haig. And this is the way Sadat had made a new cabinet arrangement with somebody to watch over Mubarak, but that didn't work, did it? Now, January the 5th, as soon as Reagan was making his transition team in Washington, ready to take the oath of office, January the 20th, 1981, in Jerusalem, those same weeks when Reagan had moved to Washington and was setting up to take the oath of office here, there were warnings in the Jerusalem Post that Sadat was going to change his cabinet, that he was going to stop the power drive of his vice president and his closest associates were watching Sadat. So this effort was stopped. It didn't work, and Mubarak was not watched by a special cabinet position that was created. There was a minister for presidential affairs that was created, a new post by Sadat to keep an eye on his vice president. But it was translated in this article in the LA Examiner as saying it merely meant to assist the president in controlling the vice president. And January the 7th, 1981, the newsman who caught out into the power struggle in Egypt was expelled from Egypt. He picked up the story of Mubarak, and evidently there were plans for a long time to get rid of Sadat. At least somebody caught on as early as January that this was a double ploy, that he was acting so close and loyal and so forth. So that journalist was kicked out of Egypt, probably so that he wouldn't pick up any more clues or talk to people in Egypt about this situation, and he was forced to leave. That reminds me of the Russian journalists, two of them, that were kicked out of Egypt just 3 weeks ago, September the 15th, and it could be that they picked up wind of this plot that would kill Sadat, or if they were around, they would expose the people inside Mubarak's administration and the army and the palace coup that took place, and throwing out the Russian ambassador and the Russian journalist just 3 weeks ago might have been because they were getting wind of this interplay between the president and the vice president, just as it was published in the Israeli newspaper and so forth. There are differences in the men's policy, and no one is suggesting at this point, the Los Angeles Examiner said, that these tensions caused the assassination, but many people believe that Mubarak had prior knowledge of the assassination attempt, and they're hinting that he had a role in it. And they said, and this was just this weekend, it's strange he was the only leader sitting close to Sadat that escaped unhurt. That this may not just have been random grenades or random shooting, that he was the only leader close to him. And of course, that reminds me of John Connally sitting in the car with John Kennedy the day of the assassination on John Kennedy in Dallas, Texas. He wasn't at first going to be in the same car with John Kennedy in the motorcade, but he survived and had a few more injuries than Mubarak. But the Examiner called attention to the fact that there were conflicts and that he escaped unhurt. Now, the security forces, according to this article on the feud, were worse than zero. They ran in different directions. And I have four or five articles just from a few newspapers telling the failure of the security forces around Sadat. And they had to be bad, because if the CIA knew ahead of time and if Sadat knew ahead of time, he could have had a bulletproof vest. They could have had an ambulance with extra blood instead of going 20 minutes away to a hospital. The men in the parade could have been frisked. If you can frisk 90,000 people at a Rolling Stones concert for a weapon or a knife or ammunition, they could have been careful with these grenades and so forth to frisk these people. So this article, in relationship to the feud of the men, points out the security forces being negligent, and that the vice president seemed to be aware of this. And also, Mubarak has no warm personal contacts with any Israeli political figures. He's described as austere, cold personality, no record, as I say, with Israel at all. He's described as calculated, shrewd on his part, and the Israeli informants say privately that there's many questions raised about his mastery of the Egyptian army. He came from the Air Force, and he may have his own private group around him, and he could have been the big threat, and was, to Anwar Sadat. We'll take a one-minute break and then go on some more to some interesting information on this murder.
This concludes the first half of World Watchers International with Mae Brussel. We will return with the second half after a brief pause.